accepted it a few days later when she was in the shower, curious as to whether or not she would have changed it after giving it to him. To his pleasure, she had not, and he'd always remembered that he had access to her machine if ever he could find a moment when he was 100% certain she wouldn't catch him. Now, as he sat down in front of the laptop and pulled her fob out of his jacket, he told himself he had never been more certain of anything in his life. He typed in the password and the screen came to life. Then he launched the virtual private network access. A few seconds later, he was prompted to enter the direct domain credentials and the current code on Eve's DDA fob. Access granted. With a sigh of relief, he slid the crawler drive into a USB port. It was a self-executing program, and instantly it launched onto Interlink TS and began looking for specific server locations where high-level intelligence data was stored. Ethan didn't know how this crawler was created or who created it, but it seemed to know exactly which servers to access and how to reach in and pull out the pertinent information. Outside hackers often execute their exploitations with days, weeks, or even months of virtual reconnaissance, picking through the data to look for critical information. But Ethan didn't have anything like that amount of time. He had hours. Just a few hours, in fact. He assumed Eve would be missed at work in the morning. It wouldn't take long for people to go to her house looking for her, and it wouldn't take long for people to look at her DDA logon history on the virtual private network. Her body would be discovered when entry was made at his house, and that would happen when he didn't show up for work in the morning. Ethan looked at his watch and saw it was now 1:30 a.m. He knew the transfer rate over the virtual private network would be 100 megabits per second, a small fraction of the speed on the network itself. Though he had a full terabyte of storage space on his drive, a terabyte of data would take 21 hours to download, and he didn't think for a second he had anything like that amount of time. Instead, he decided he'd give himself 4 hours. That would give him 150 gigabytes of top-secret intelligence, and that would just have to do. He headed downstairs to brew himself some coffee, moving slowly in the dark. 26. Ethan was already sitting on the bench by the cannon in Fort Marcy Park when Gianna Bertoli and Harlan Banfield arrived just before 8 a.m. As they approached, he sat up straighter and looked down at his clothes. They were wrinkled and dirty. He was certain his face was drawn and gaunt, and he could see straight blonde hair, hair that he normally kept swept back with molding clay, now hanging in his eyes. He had a black backpack secured on his back, and he wore a Washington Nationals cap on his head and sunglasses he'd bought at a CVS up in Bethesda. Harlan stepped up to him and shook his hand. I saw the chalk mark. Damn, son. It looks like you've slept here all night. He shook his head back and forth slowly. Bertoli offered him a hug. Ethan stood up and embraced her, his body heavy with exhaustion. They tried to kill me. Bertoli gasped while Banfield made a face of disbelief. Kill you? What on earth are you talking about? A man in a car. Last night. He shot at me. Ethan shrugged. Then he added, "He missed. He killed Eve instead." Banfield grabbed Ethan by the arms. "Oh my God. How can you be sure? You're not a doctor." "Shot through the fucking heart, Harlan. It doesn't take a doctor." "Who did it?" Bertoli answered before Ethan. "Mossad. I'd bet my life. You are that important." Banfield started pacing back and forth. "Where is her body?" "On my living room floor." "Christ, son. What the hell was I supposed to do? I wasn't going to bury her in the fucking backyard, and I couldn't call an ambulance.
Yes, of course not,
said Banfield. He looked to Ross like an old man who just realized he was in way over his head.
What do I do now?
Banfield didn't answer. He didn't look like he had a clue. But Gianna emanated an air of calm. She put her hand on his cheek.
You run, Ethan. You run.
Run where? Bertoli said, It might surprise you to know it, but the Venezuelans have a very good operation here in Washington. Their embassy has been helpful with our efforts in the past. A few times they were able to provide quick and discreet assistance.
Venezuela helps American whistleblowers? I never heard about that.
She gave a half smile.
I told you they were good. The incidents never came to light.
The feds didn't find out about them?
They discovered the actions and identities of the whistleblowers, yes. But they had their reasons for keeping the incidents quiet. Your case is much the same. If you stay quiet, then they will stay quiet. But the key is getting out of the country as soon as you know they are coming for you. If you are still around, they will grab you, and no one will hear from you again.
Ethan looked to Banfield. The older man just nodded gravely. Ethan said, The guys who went to Venezuela, are they still there? Bertoli said, Last I heard, Juan was living in Paris. Nicely, I might add. A prominent journalist. I visited him last fall.
You're kidding.
Another went to Buenos Aires. He married a local down there. A third returned to the U.S. She was given immunity from prosecution in exchange for her leaving government service. She's teaching at a prominent university in South Florida now. Bertoli smiled. A good trade, I should think. Miami is beautiful. But more important, in all these cases, the government decided to drop the charges because the whistleblowers had taken more data that they never exploited, when they simply returned that data and agreed to leave government service forever in exchange for the government calling off the chase. Everything stayed quiet.
Ross reacted as if he had been thrown a lifeline.
That's what I need, Gianna. I don't want my mother thrown into a big scandal. I don't want to be chased around by fucking hitmen. I just need this bullshit to blow over.
She said, Venezuela will help you, I'm sure of it. But they won't do it for free. If you had something to offer them, I could contact a friend of theirs and make arrangements.
Ethan smiled for the first time today.
I did it. I have it.
The scrape?
Yes. 150 gigs, all categorized and searchable.
Oh, Ethan. That is wonderful. Ross thought about what gems he could pull from the Interlink TS scrape that the Venezuelans would find valuable. I can get the names of all CIA contracted personnel working in their country. Will that buy me a ticket out of town?
Bertoli smiled. I feel certain it would.
I'll give them something to let them know I have the goods they want. But the bulk of it will stay on the drive and encrypted until I am out of the U.S.
I think that would be agreeable to them.
Gianna thought for a moment. I'll need a few hours to set it up. We will hide you out until then.
No, Ethan said quickly. I have something I need to do first. I'll meet up with you two later today.
You aren't safe alone.
I'll take my chances. I need about 4 or 5 hours.
Bertoli gave Ethan the phone number to a mobile she'd purchased here in D.C. and had not yet activated, and told him to call her as soon as he was ready. Ethan put the number in his phone, but he looked at Banfield.
What about you, Harlan?
Banfield had been silent, but he said, This is where you and I say goodbye.
I am the local director of the ITP. I won't be handling you when you go abroad. The small and frumpy man looked whiter than usual. He hadn't recovered since Ethan told him about the assassin, obviously, but he shook Ross's hand and wished him luck. "Be careful, son," he said, and Ethan headed back up the trail alone, while the other two watched him leave. Darren Albright shuffled in his seat, annoyed by the delays, but energized by the anticipation of action. He checked the time on his mobile phone for the third time in the last 10 minutes and drummed his fingers on the dashboard of the black GMC Yukon while he looked out the window at 1598 34th Street, a two-story whitewashed row house. There had been a virtual cavalcade of suspicious events today, and they all led Albright here to the home of National Security Council Deputy Assistant Director Ethan J. Ross. It all began when Albright learned Ethan Ross called in sick to work this morning. This in itself wasn't noteworthy, other than the fact he was now a person of interest in a federal Official Secrets Act investigation. Second, the special surveillance group team that had been covertly waiting for him outside his house had reported no activity by 10 a.m. If Ross was indeed ill, this meant nothing. But Albright's suspicions began to grow that he was not even home. Around 11, real alarm bells began ringing when Albright received word that Ross's girlfriend, Eve Pang, an IT expert at Booz Allen Hamilton, had not shown up for a meeting she had scheduled with IT personnel at Joint Base Anacostia Bowling. She was due in at 8, but since she bounced around to many different remote locations, no one marked her as missing for nearly 3 hours. Albright himself called her mobile and received no answer, so he sent agents to her place in Bethesda with authorization to force entry if necessary. The agents kicked in the front door when there was no answer, and inside they found no sign of Ms. Pang, and no sign of anything out of the ordinary. Immediately upon hearing from his men in Bethesda, Albright dropped all other activity on the case and put the full force of his resources into locating Ethan Ross and Eve Pang. At the same time, he applied for an order to make entry on Ross's home. Ross wasn't officially missing, so he couldn't kick his door in without a warrant. But while he waited on the warrant, he ordered a bolo be sent out to local D.C. police on both Ross and Pang. Albright and 3 special agents arrived at Ross's home at 1 p.m. A pair of SSG surveillance experts had been undercover as landscapers in the park across the street, and they'd notified Albright that they'd seen no signs anyone was home. But at this point, the supervisory special agent decided to just go up to the door and knock. There was no answer. He walked around the outside of the building, banged on the basement door and the back door, and then returned to his Yukon to wait for the warrant and to monitor the SSG radio traffic while they looked for their missing persons of interest. A D.C. Metro police officer ID'd Ross at 3 p.m. She noticed a man who looked much like the image on the computer screen in her squad car as he climbed out of a cab on Pennsylvania Avenue. He wore sunglasses and a ball cap and carried a black backpack, and to the police officer he looked like a shady character, so she called in the sighting to dispatch. Within 5 minutes, a pair of SSG officers had raced into the area and took up watch on the man. Through the long-range lenses of their cameras, they confirmed their target, and they watched as Ross climbed into another taxi. As the cab rolled down the street, a full 16-person SSG follow team converged on it. Not everyone who works for the FBI, even on operational status, is a special agent. The Special Surveillance Group is an FBI entity charged with investigative support functions for the Bureau, meaning physical surveillance operations. They carry FBI credentials, but they don't have authority to make arrests, and they don't carry firearms in the field. The ranks of the SSG are filled with men and women of all shapes, sizes, colors, and backgrounds,
because a key component of the work is appearing ordinary, not standing out like a Fed, even to a target who knows full well what a Fed looks like. The surveillance specialists who operate in the follow teams are trained in the ability to remain in the shadows while tailing their subjects in vehicles and on foot. SSG investigative specialists Beale and Nolan were working together this afternoon, tailing their subject's vehicle as part of the six-vehicle team. The two men were both white males, riding around D.C. in a vehicle together, and this ran the risk of tipping off their target that they were feds, except for the fact Beale drove a maroon taxi, and Nolan was his passenger in the back seat. Beale was 21 years old and had worked for a package delivery service before landing this job with the FBI. Nolan was 46, and he'd been a cop in a suburb of Des Moines before deciding he wanted to do something more interesting with his time than ticketing speeders and busting teenage drinkers at high school football games. So he answered an online ad for the FBI, and within months found himself tailing foreign spies throughout the streets of D.C., usually on behalf of the FBI's counterintelligence division. This afternoon's subject, Ethan J. Ross, was different from their average mark. He was American, a relatively high-ranking employee of the National Security Council, and, if Beale and Nolan's brief from Special Agent Darren Albright was to be believed, he was a potential insider threat to the U.S. intelligence community. Both SSG men had backpacks in the cab with them containing various articles of clothing, eyeglasses, hats, and other forms of disguise, but rolling around D.C. in a taxi was a great way to blend in, and they had no plans to ditch their car for a foot follow this afternoon. That said, surveillance was always dictated by the person under surveillance, so Beale and Nolan had to be ready to ad lib if the situation called for it. The six-vehicle team had picked Ross up 10 minutes earlier from the police tip, and now they stayed in a box pattern in the very familiar streets of the capital as Ross's cab meandered through traffic. They drove into Georgetown, where Ross was dropped off in front of the Nike store on M Street. Fortunately for the SSG team, one of their vehicles had been passing by at the exact moment Ross climbed out, because the delivery van that had been serving as the eye lost sight of him on the previous turn. Beale and Nolan's vehicle's movements, like the movements of all the cars, trucks, scooters, and motorcycles on the team, were directed by an operations hub that maintained radio contact with all the officers via earpieces. Their taxi was several cars out of rotation when Ross left his cab, so they followed orders to move east of the subject's location and park on Thomas Jefferson Street. They resumed the eye again a few minutes later as he walked south through Georgetown. They took a few pictures of the man with the National's cap and the backpack, but they did it from a distance so as not to risk compromise.
"Any guesses as to where he's going?" Nolan asked as he slid the camera back in his bag.
Beale thought for a moment.
"If he's dirty and working with a foreign intel service, he could be heading to any of a dozen embassies around here."
Nolan said, "Close up just a little. If it looks like we're going to lose him, they might authorize an in extremis arrest. If we have to bail out to tackle this guy, I don't want to get into a foot chase. This prick looks like a runner."
Beale said, "I'd love it if he was a runner. I've been involved in a couple of arrests, but I've never done a foot chase."
"Kid, you can be my guest. I chased my sherry yahoos when I was a cop in Iowa. I'll sit here and watch."
"Man, I don't believe that. If that dude starts running, you know you'll start hauling ass after him."
Nolan smiled.
"Yeah. Shit gets in your blood."
He turned serious again. "Still, tighten up. He looks fast." Beale chuckled and brought the taxi a little closer and reported his location to the operations hub on the other end of the radio. 27. Darren Albright sat in his Yukon, staring at Ethan Ross's house just 20 feet away. The damn warrant was taking forever, but to bide his time he had a walkie-talkie in his hand, and with it he listened in on the SSG tale of one of his two persons of interest. From Albright's mental picture of Ross's movements, it seemed like he was on a dry-cleaning run at the moment, which made him look even more suspicious. One of the agents in the back seat of the Yukon was obviously thinking the same thing, because he mumbled something about maybe moving Ross from person of interest status up to suspect status. But before Albright had time to reply, his phone chirped in his pocket. He quickly stowed the walkie-talkie on his hip and answered his phone. Yeah? Okay, good. He pocketed the phone and turned to the men in the SUV with him. Warrant came through. We're good to go. Let's see what's what in that house. He climbed out of the SUV, and his three agents followed suit. One went around to the back of 1598 34th Street, while Albright and the two others took the six steps up to the front door. He banged on the door once, shouted, FBI! Search warrant! The three men drew their service weapons, 40-caliber Sig Sauer pistols, and Albright himself kicked at the door. It had been a long time since he'd had the pleasure of a kinetic breach, but he executed it perfectly. The door cracked at the lock and splintered, and it opened fully, setting off a wailing security alarm siren. Albright ignored the noise, and he led the men through the door, his gun high in front of him. But that single step was all it took for him to register a smell he was trained to recognize, even though he'd never quite gotten used to it. "That's a cadaver," he said over the sound of the alarm, and then he moved farther inside so that his men could sweep the area. He found Eve Pang behind the sofa in the middle of the room. Albright was certain she was dead, but he knelt to check her pulse anyway. As the other two agents slipped quietly into the hallway to begin clearing the rest of the house, Albright pulled his walkie-talkie to his mouth. It was already set on the channel that communicated directly with the head of the SSG team following Ross. He shouted over the siren. "This is Supervisory Special Agent Albright. I want Ethan Ross picked up right now. Consider him armed and dangerous." The terse reply came back instantly. "Understood." Albright stood from the body, hooked his walkie-talkie back on his belt, and shook his head in disbelief. Son of a bitch. For the third time on this surveillance operation, Nolan and Beale had taken over the eye from one of their colleagues, this time a 50-year-old woman driving a Vespa. They'd tailed Ross into the promenade of Washington Harbor, a dual-use office building shopping area with a large public space. Ross was on foot in a pedestrian zone, but they could see him from their vantage point on Thomas Jefferson, so they'd remained in their cab for now. While they parked along the curb, they helped route other cars into the area to control exit points off the promenade, and the operations hub rushed officers to the ferry boats that left from the harbor for Potomac cruises, just in case the subject tried to board. Beale had positioned his taxi so that he could pick Ross back up first if he decided to skirt around the harbor complex and walk back up north into the heart of Georgetown. The concern remained the man would try to slip into an embassy, and Georgetown was loaded with potential places for a spy to run and hide. Just as Ross slipped out of sight in the promenade, a call came through both men's earpieces. "Uniform Victor, this is Control. Maintain the eye while we move SWAT to your location. Immediate arrest has been authorized, but we are advised subject is now considered armed and dangerous." Beale and Nolan were designated Uniform Victor. Beale responded into his headset, "Roger that. We'll have him again in 20 seconds. He glanced at his passenger in back. "This clown doesn't look armed and dangerous." Nolan rolled his eyes. "Everybody's armed and dangerous to SWAT. Otherwise they wouldn't have shit to do." "I hear you." Fortunately, Beale saw Ethan Ross walking north, back up the hill into Georgetown on 31st. Beale pulled in well behind him, stayed far back, keeping other cars between his cab and the man walking on the sidewalk. Nolan called into the operations hub, telling them to put a unit back on M Street, a couple 100 yards up the hill. It was the next major intersection ahead, and therefore the next decision point for Ross, unless he went into a building or turned down a little alleyway.
"Might be taking the towpath," said Nolan.
Beale said, "Shit, you're right. If he does, we'll lose the eye here in a second." To both men's surprise, however, Ethan Ross made a quick right off 31st Street into a narrow alley that led back over to Thomas Jefferson. Their taxi had been the unit stationed on Thomas Jefferson a couple minutes before, so they knew there would be no eye on their subject on the far side of that alley. Beale called it into control, who replied it would take at least 90 seconds to move a vehicle back onto Thomas Jefferson.
"Shit," Beale muttered to Nolan.
"Do I follow through the alley?" Nolan hesitated, then said,
"Just pull up and take a look from the street. Don't want to get stuck in a one-lane alleyway if we don't have to."
The cab stopped at the mouth of the alley. In the distance, Ross was already more than halfway to Thomas Jefferson. Beale said, "We're going to lose him. He can grab the towpath or head back down to K or up to M, or he could..."
"Go,"
ordered Nolan. The cab pulled into the narrow alley just as Ross made a left 100 yards in front of them.
"I'll call it in," said Beale.
He rolled slowly, keeping his eyes peeled left and right in case Ross had a spotter helping him on his dry-cleaning run. While he drove, he touched his finger to his earpiece.
"Operations Hub, this is Uniform Victor. We are eastbound to T. Jeff. Subject just made a left out of an alley. Still on foot."
"Roger." As the hub scrambled to route another vehicle into the area, Beale picked up speed in the little alley, hoping he'd be able to catch a helpful glimpse of Ross before he reached a decision point and disappeared from view. But as he passed the midway point through the alleyway, he had to slow because a pair of big garbage dumpsters were positioned along the wall on his left, cutting his clearance down to less than a foot. Just as he drew abreast with the cans, a large, dusty blue van backed out of a covered parking lot in front of him and stopped just feet from the grill of his cab. Beale had to slam on his brakes to avoid a collision. He lowered his window.
"Move it, asshole!"
Nolan looked back over his shoulder and saw a sedan with tinted windows pull into the alleyway behind them. It stopped 20 feet back, blocking the cab in next to the dumpsters. Beale saw the second car as well, and instantly he knew this was some sort of an ambush.
"I'm ramming them!"
Beale slammed the transmission into reverse because the sedan was smaller, lighter, and a few feet farther away than the van.
"Do it!"
urged Nolan. But before Beale could step on the gas, two men in black masks and black wool coats stepped out from between the dumpsters, just a foot from the driver's side of the taxi. As one, they raised black pistols with long silencers. Nolan screamed,
"Watch out!"
Behind them, the sedan driver leaned on his horn, masking the sound as the two masked men opened fire on the cab, peppering both the driver's side and the passenger windows with round after round from their suppressed pistols. The two SSG surveillance officers crumpled onto the seats next to them. The cab rolled back until it came to rest gently against the parked sedan, which was no longer blaring its horn. Iranian Quds Force operatives Ormond and Kashan quickly slipped their weapons back inside their coats. With no words between the two gunmen, they reached through the broken windows and opened both the front and back doors. They pushed the bloody American bodies farther inside the car and out of their way. Ormond climbed behind the wheel while Kashan sat in the back. They rolled down the broken windows, cleared away shattered glass from the doors, and watched while Shiraz moved the van out of the way in front of them and then turned toward Thomas Jefferson. The cab followed suit behind, making a right at the mouth of the alley. Behind them, Isfahan climbed out of the sedan with a long device in his hands that looked something like a metal broom. It was a nail hog magnetic nail sweeper, used by roofers for collecting loose roofing nails in grass. Quickly and calmly, he rolled the device back and forth in the alley where his two colleagues had been standing, and he picked up 11 spent shell casings from their weapons. He was back in his sedan a moment later, heading down the alley to 31st Street.
Before the four Iranian assassins had even left the neighborhood, Ethan Ross entered in the side door of the Venezuelan embassy two blocks away on 30th Street, completely unaware of what had happened behind him, and completely undetected by either U.S. intelligence or law enforcement.
28.
For the first few hours, Ethan Ross sat alone in a windowless office on the ground floor of the Venezuelan embassy. He was given coffee, and then a snack, and finally a meal, Vietnamese food from a restaurant on M Street, and he sat alone at a conference table and ate. All the while, more than 5 hours in the place, and no one interviewed him, interrogated him, or did anything more than peek in on him from time to time to see to his needs. So he sat at a conference table, or on a small sofa next to it the entire time, his backpack looped around his arms and hanging off his chest, as if the pack that held his computer and other equipment were an infant. At around 9 p.m., an attractive woman in her 20s entered the office. Ethan had pegged her earlier as an intelligence officer, and with a smile she invited Gianna Bertoli into the small room. Ethan stood to hug her, not because he needed the Swiss woman's comforting embrace, but rather because he knew Gianna would offer a hug. Ethan was happy for the chance to find out what was going on from someone he trusted. "Where have you been? How much longer am I going to be sitting here?" Gianna sat back down at the conference table with him. "I've been here all day, mostly upstairs in conference calls with agents here in the embassy, as well as counterintelligence agents in Caracas."
"What's taking so long?"
"It was all going smoothly, but then some sort of a problem developed on the streets outside."
"What sort of problem?"
"Police. A lot of police. For the first hour or two, the Venezuelans thought they were looking for you. They began to grow concerned about this entire enterprise, thinking if the Americans knew about you already, then they would have a hard time getting you out of the country. They talked of contacting the State Department and turning you over. I insisted that the intelligence you have would make it worth their while, but they remained noncommittal."
"Bastards."
"It's okay. It seems whatever is going on here in Georgetown is unrelated to you. The police are looking for a taxi with two occupants, but they aren't providing any more information than that. This placated the Venezuelans, and everything is back on track."
Just then, the door opened again, and a tall, handsome Latin American man with salt-and-pepper hair entered, trailed by the female intelligence officer Ethan had met earlier. He introduced himself as Arturo, and Ethan determined instantly he was General Intelligence Office, the foreign arm of Venezuelan intelligence. He offered Ross and Bertoli coffee, and another good-looking female brought it in a moment later. There was a little small talk. Ethan asked questions about the police presence out in the streets, but Arturo knew no more than Gianna had already told him. Soon the small talk trailed off, and Arturo got down to business.
"Now, Mr. Ross, we agree to your terms. We will remove you safely from the United States and take you to Caracas, where you will be both protected and free to come and go whenever you wish."
He held up a finger.
"With the provision, you provide documentary evidence of all American agents working for the CIA in Venezuela."
Ethan shook his head.
"No. I will not give you everything."
"I don't understand."
"I will give you a portion of what I have."
Ethan smiled. "But it will be more than enough to keep your organization busy, I promise you that. Once I'm safely in Venezuela, I'll give you the rest." The truth was, Ethan had no idea what sources the CIA had in Venezuela. He'd never given it a moment's thought. He felt certain there would be something, however, and even if he had to give every last shred of relevant intelligence to Arturo right now and lie about there being more on the drive, he was going to do whatever it took to get a ticket out of the USA.
tonight.
Muy bien, said Arturo. What do you need from us?
I need an office with a printer. I will print out the files from my computer. Arturo took him down a staircase to a door off a basement lobby, and he unlocked the door with a key card. With a flourish, he bowed, and Ethan stepped alone into a small dormitory room with a computer and a printer on a simple desk against the wall. Arturo closed the door, leaving Ethan alone inside. He put his laptop on the desk, then pulled the comforter off the bed. He threw the comforter over his head, covering the laptop as well. This way, if there were hidden cameras in the room, they wouldn't see him enter his password. He had the NASCAR drive in his backpack, but he did not retrieve it. Instead, he reached down inside the front of his pants and felt along his waist, just above his left hip. He pulled a small, flesh-colored moleskin bandage off his skin and then brought it out of his pants. Stuck to the inside of it was a tiny micro SD card, roughly the size of a fingernail. He pried it from the moleskin and placed it into an adapter from his backpack. He'd come up with the scheme to hide the scrape on his own, and he'd transferred the files from the NASCAR drive during his several hours this morning after leaving Fort Marcy Park. Now the NASCAR drive was blank, as was his computer, but both devices were heavily encrypted, so anyone attempting to recover the Interlink TS files would have no way of knowing Ethan had relocated them to a tiny device he kept hidden on his body. It wasn't a perfect solution, but Ethan liked feeling that he had some semblance of control over events. Once his computer read the micro SD card, he entered a series of passwords, and soon he was in. It took 3 minutes to pull up a massive, cataloged database, U.S. top secret intelligence out of Interlink TS. He typed some search terms into a wiki-like program, waited an instant for the search engine to do its thing, and then he smiled. In front of him was a motherload of intelligence about U.S. assets in Venezuela, all well categorized and easy to sort and read. As he scrolled through page after page of raw intel source documents, he saw there were no names per se, because they were redacted before going onto the network, but the identities of specific agents could be quite easily discerned. One file relayed the CIA's relationship with the assistant manager of the Caracas office of Conviasa, the state-owned national air carrier of Venezuela. Another file dealt with two concierges at the Gran Melia Caracas Hotel who'd been passing information to Langley for years. A series of documents defined an operation that utilized help from the chief of police of the city of Maracaibo. Ethan even saw that the Assistant Deputy Minister of Interior and Justice was a CIA agent on the take. The files went on and on. It took more than an hour, but eventually Ethan pulled up hundreds of documents from CIA files, giving vague but identifiable personalities of 33 agents in Venezuela, and he printed them all out. He could have kept working and pulled another 50 or 60 names, but he wanted to save the rest for when he got to Caracas. He spent several more minutes clearing all his cache on his computer and then signing out and shutting down. When he was finished, he took off the comforter, put the drive back in the moleskin, and reattached it to his hip. He threw the backpack onto his shoulder and then left the room, heading back upstairs to the office. Gianna Bertoli, the GIO officer who had introduced himself as Arturo, and two young female Venezuelans looked up from the sofas where they were sitting. Ethan noticed a pair of young men in suits standing by the elevators in the lobby down the hall now. He assumed they were security, and he appreciated their presence, but he wasn't 100% certain they weren't here to keep him in, as opposed to keeping others out. Arturo stood from the conference table.
So, what do you have for us?
Ethan handed over the printed pages and said a list of 23 Venezuelan citizens and 10 foreign nationals living in Venezuela, who are all in the employ of the Central Intelligence Agency.
33 men and women, mostly in Caracas, who were currently spying on the Venezuelan government. One of the women spoke softly.
Increíble.
Arturo started going through the pages silently. Ethan looked to Bertoli, but he addressed the Venezuelans. This is just the tip of the iceberg, believe me. Once I get somewhere safe, I can get you more identities. A list of front companies in Venezuela, CIA informants working at your consular offices all over the world, and information about CIA's reach into Venezuela's oil and banking sectors. Ethan raised his eyebrows.
It's really interesting stuff. I should think you would want to see it.
Arturo nodded gravely.
I very much do want to see it.
Then he smiled.
I agree to your terms. We will leave for Caracas at once.
Excellent, said Bertoli.
Dom sat alone in his condo, thinking about going out for a night on the town. He wasn't in the mood for it, really, but this afternoon he'd done little more than sit around, and he felt like getting out. Adara Sherman had stopped by an hour earlier. Dom didn't answer the door. He knew it was her because through the blinds he saw her car parked outside. His place was a mess, and he didn't feel like having company, especially company who had dropped in on him only to check him out and evaluate his physical and mental state for his boss, Jerry Hendley. Dom didn't think either his physical or his mental state should be on display at the moment. Just as he stood to head into his bedroom to change for a few hours of bar hopping, there was a new knock at the door. At first he thought Sherman had returned. He groaned, but figured he might as well let her in and get it over with. But when he looked through the peephole, he saw a familiar man wearing a dark blue suit. He opened the door.
Albright. Can I come in?
Of course. Albright didn't sit down. Instead, he just stood in Dom's living room, his hands on his hips. Caruso assumed the special agent brought some news. Albright's body language was all wrong for someone who was going to either gloat or celebrate. No, Dom knew before he said a word, Albright was here because something bad had happened.
I thought you should know, he said. It looks like you were right about Ethan Ross.
Dom raised an eyebrow.
How did you figure that out?
His girlfriend.
She's in on it?
Not looking like it.
Why not?
Found her body in Ross's living room. Shot once in the torso. DRT. Caruso knew DRT was unofficial cop speak, meaning dead right there. Caruso blew out a gasp.
Who did it? Ross?
I don't know. No record of him having a gun. But you know how that is. A guy who wants to kill somebody can find a gun easily enough.
That's true.
We'll investigate all possibilities. Dom didn't understand the comment. He asked, where is Ross now? Disappeared. Caruso looked at the ceiling in frustration. And we've lost a couple of SSG guys during the hunt.
What the hell does that mean, lost?
They and the taxi they were in vanished about 3 o'clock this afternoon, just prior to SWAT moving in for an arrest. If Ross killed Pang to silence her, he would have had no compunction about killing to save himself.
Yeah.
I know what you're thinking, Caruso.
I bet you do.
You're thinking, this is my fault. You're telling yourself if we just grabbed Ross by the throat the first time his name popped up, Pang would still be alive, and my two guys wouldn't be missing.
Dom did not reply.
We don't operate under black ops rules in the FBI. You might have forgotten that, but it's the law.
Yeah. I used to be a law and order man myself, Dom said. It only gets you so far.
That's a dangerous thing to say to me, Caruso.
I just think you should have bent the rules a little with this one, Albright, shaken a little harder.
Albright kept his hands on his hips, his eyes on Caruso. Dom softened. He shouldn't have been so hard on the guy. He was doing his best. Anything I can do to help? Yes. You can give me your gun. I want to run ballistics on it.
What?
Look, it's just to rule you out. I don't think for a moment the president's nephew murdered Eve Pang, but you are an armed man running wild through the middle of all this shit, so I would be a fool if I didn't at least check off the box that says you're clean. Caruso thought about protesting, but he knew that would just make Albright get a warrant and come back. So he stepped to his bookshelf, grabbed his shoulder rig out of its hiding spot, and pulled his Smith & Wesson from its holster. He dropped the magazine out, racked the slide to eject the round in the chamber, and locked the gun open. He handed it to Albright. I want a receipt for that. Albright closed the slide and slid the empty weapon into his waistband. Of course. That is standard operating procedure. You'd know, wouldn't you? 29. Ethan Ross was spirited out of the Venezuelan embassy at 12:12 a.m., face down on the floorboard in the back seat of an Infiniti sedan, driven out of the garage by the young female intelligence officer with a security man in the front passenger seat. In the back with Ross, with their feet gently resting on his back, were two male IOs. Ethan lay on his backpack, protecting it and its contents with his body. The four Venezuelans had been instructed to do everything in their power to avoid losing the American NSC staffer, up to and including initiating high-speed flight from the police in the event there was an attempt to pull them over. A second vehicle, this one a Cadillac Escalade, trailed behind the Infiniti, serving as a chase car, ready to swoop in to take Ross away if necessary. But the Infiniti was neither tailed nor stopped, and after 45 minutes of travel it pulled into the hangar of a fixed base operator at Dulles Airport. Everyone else left the car, but Ethan was told to sit up and wait a few minutes so the others could check the area to make sure they were clear before he walked to the plane. Ethan climbed off the floorboard of the car, checking the contents of his backpack even before he stretched his sore muscles. He put his hand around the battery pack for the phone Banfield had instructed him to purchase earlier in the week. He had removed it before heading toward the Venezuelan embassy the previous afternoon out of an abundance of caution, and now it, and the phone itself, were crammed into the bottom of his backpack. He suddenly realized this would be his last moment in the United States for an indeterminate amount of time. Gianna promised him his life would get back on track once a deal was reached with the government, but that was before the assassination attempt. Now all bets were off that he could ever come home. He also didn't know what would be waiting for him when he got to Venezuela. On a whim, he snapped the battery back into the phone, powered it up, and dialed his mother's house in San Francisco. It was 10 p.m. there, and even if Ross hadn't done the math to determine this, he would have been able to figure it out from his mother's voice. She was tired and annoyed and concerned all at once.
Who's calling?
Mom, it's me.
Ethan? Ethan, what's wrong?
Nothing. Well, I just wanted to call.
Why?
Emily Ross was wide awake now.
What's happened?
Everything will be okay. I just wanted to tell you not to worry.
Worry about what?
I'm worried now. Talk to me. The car door opened, and the female I.O. looked at Ethan angrily.
I have to go. Forget I called. I'll call you tomorrow if I can.
Why wouldn't you be able to... Love you. He hung up just as the young woman yanked the phone out of his hand. She removed the battery, and Ethan got out. He took a moment to get his bearings, and he realized he was standing next to a Beechcraft King Air 350i. He was not impressed with the aircraft. It was a twin turboprop, not a jet. Ethan's work both at State and in the NSC gave him a lot of experience traveling on smaller jets as he moved around the world, and he couldn't help registering a little disappointment that his escape from the United States would be in a plane that flew slower than he would have liked. Ethan felt his contribution to Venezuela's intelligence services would have earned him an aircraft of higher performance. The female Venezuelan spy took the phone to Arturo, who was conferring with others near the plane. He stormed back over to Ross by the Infinity. Ethan held his hand up.
Don't worry. No one can trace it. I bought it today in Reston. No one knows I have it. It's not in my name. The call I just made was the only time I used it.
This placated Arturo somewhat, but the woman said,
We will have to frisk you before you board the aircraft.
The hell you will. She looked to Arturo. The older man asked,
Who did you call?
My mom. I just told her I'd call her in a couple of days.
You could have compromised this mission, Mr. Ross.
The only thing compromising this mission, senor, is us standing out here in the open.
Arturo fought with his composure for a moment. Then he just motioned for Ethan to board the plane. He climbed the four steps to the cabin, still lamenting the fact his Venezuelan accomplices couldn't come up with the cash for a last-minute corporate jet charter. Once Ethan ducked his head into the small but surprisingly well-appointed cabin, he saw six others already on board. Another man from the Venezuelan embassy was here. He introduced himself as a cultural attaché and shook Ethan's hand at the door and then took a seat just behind the cockpit, directing Ethan to move to the empty captain's chair in the back of the plane. Ethan knelt and moved to the back and settled into his leather seat, and here he found himself facing Gianna Bertoli. She reached out and squeezed his hand with a smile.
Are you okay?
Ethan nodded. He wasn't okay, of course, but there wasn't anything she could do about it right now. Seated next to her, pressed up to the window, was a small, young-looking man with olive skin and short, dark hair. Ross assumed he was Venezuelan at first, although the rest of the intelligence officers in the cabin were in suits and ties, and this man was dressed like a college student. He wore blue jeans, a blue flannel shirt with a red T-shirt under it, and Ethan saw a black ski parka tucked under his elbow. On the table in front of the young man, a sub-notebook computer lay open, and he typed on it furiously, not even looking up as Ethan sat down.
Gianna said, Ethan, I would like you to meet my good friend Mohammed.
Mohammed? Ethan thought. Clearly not Venezuelan, then. Mohammed glanced in Ethan's direction now and offered a hand, smiling nervously.
I am pleased to meet you.
Bertoli said,
Mohammed has been working with us for more than a year now.
Really? In what capacity? The question was directed at Mohammed, but Gianna answered for him.
He is one of our best hacktivists. He has been incredibly helpful.
Where are you from?
Mohammed's eyes danced around the cabin, everywhere but on Ethan. He answered, Lebanon,
then looked back down. Ethan nodded. And you will be traveling all the way to Venezuela with us?
Yes, sir. If that is okay with you.
Ethan shrugged.
The young man seemed odd, uncomfortable. Ethan couldn't put his finger on it, but despite the Lebanese man's decidedly non-threatening demeanor, he made Ethan a little uneasy.
Ethan looked to Gianna, and she just smiled back at him.
We are almost on our way. Your future awaits, Ethan. Please don't worry. I will take care of you.
The plane's engines fired, and soon they were rolling out of the hangar. The Beechcraft bounced and bucked on its initial climb out over Virginia, but as it banked to the south, the air smoothed out, and by the time they reached their cruising altitude of 25,000 feet, Ethan was drinking a Bloody Mary and picking at a bag of chips. By his second cocktail, his attention returned to the Lebanese computer geek in front of him, and he began asking Mohammed questions to see if the man was, in fact, who he said he was. When Mohammed claimed he received his undergrad at the American University of Beirut, Ethan knew he'd be able to test the man's truthfulness, as he knew several professors there through his work at the NSC. He asked the young man about his studies, and his suspicions were allayed when Mohammed mentioned some familiar names at the university. Next, Ethan asked him about his work as a hacktivist, and even though he seemed a little strange and discomforted, from a computer science standpoint, Mohammed had no problem discussing denial-of-service attacks, computer trojans and worms, and several other technical aspects of computer hacking. Ethan decided the man was what he said he was, a Lebanese computer hacker, which put him somewhat at ease. As they talked, Ethan noted the young man's edginess in interpersonal communication. In Mohammed, Ethan recognized a unique intellect and a familiar level of awkwardness that often came with true genius. Still, Ethan decided there was more there, something Mohammed was keeping to himself. Gianna Bertoli sat quietly while the two men talked, but when things quieted down an hour or so after leaving D.C., she put her hand on Ethan's knee. Ethan, you are not running away. You are removing from the American government their one option to end this on their terms. Ethan nodded, but he bristled hearing Bertoli refer to the FBI as the American government. Hell, he was every bit as much a part of the American government as the G's chasing him. Still, he let it go and asked Bertoli about how they would approach the U.S. government in an attempt to get his life back. Let's get to where we are going today, and we will discuss our plans tomorrow. We aren't safe until we get to Caracas. The King Air landed at Miami's Opa-locka Executive Airport to refuel. A customs official working there had a family member back in Venezuela serving in a low but lucrative position in the government, and the customs worker was accustomed to clearing government planes to Caracas without looking over the passengers or their luggage, thereby ensuring both her relative and herself a profitable career. By 6 a.m., they were back in the air, heading over the Gulf of Mexico. When they'd been in the air less than an hour, Arturo leaned over Gianna Bertoli and woke her with a little nudge. "Hi, Arturo. Is something wrong?" The Venezuelan addressed Ethan now. "Mr. Ross, the information you have given us has been outstanding." Ethan had been staring out over the water as they flew, his mind on his mother mostly. Now he turned to Arturo. "Of course it has. But in it, we see a serious problem." "Which is?" "If we fly you into Caracas right now, there are American agents who will know. People who need to be rounded up and arrested."
"Obviously.
So get to work on that."
"Our security services are working as we speak. But with what you have given us, there isn't time to clean up this mess before we land. The Americans have agents in our police, in our security services, in our presidential administration."
"What are you suggesting?"
"I am suggesting, senor, that we go to a safe house in a third country."
"A safe house? Where?"
"Panama. We can keep you secure there while we clean our organization of American influence. 2 or 3 days at most."
Ross didn't like it.
"You can't protect me from the U.S. government in Panama."
Arturo said, "We can, my friend. Don't worry.
Our location is quite secluded and secure. If there is any trouble, we can get you away by aircraft or boat very quickly. We have brought others there over the years."
"And the Panamanians?"
"They don't bother us."
Ethan looked at Gianna. She just nodded a little. Ethan turned to Mohammed to see if he had anything to say on the matter, but the baby-faced man was fast asleep. Arturo said,
"Trust me, amigo. With the intelligence you just gave us, going to Caracas would be the worst possible move you can make."
Ethan looked out of the window. Events were moving so quickly.
"Okay. But you won't get any more intelligence from me until we reach Caracas."
"No problem," Arturo said with a sly smile.
You have already given my organization all it can handle.
He turned away to go talk to the flight crew. Dom Caruso had spent the evening thinking about Ethan Ross. He'd promised Albright he'd stay out of the way, but within hours of his making that promise,